From KDNK Community Access Radio in Carbondale, Colorado, in the United States, this is program number 64 of the Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our romantic, our sighted friends. We don't see beautiful mountains and far-sighted traveling companions. Frequently, as people lose their eyesight, they become more and more isolated. The Tactile Traveler hopes to empower sunsets. The goal of this program is to identify and even create experiences that are more meaningful or just more fun for other people, not only to go literally around sighted friends, see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. When blind people go places, we don't experience them like on the world, but around the block to new adventures in their lives. Blind ranges from people who are visually impaired, and glasses and contact lenses no longer allow them to lead a normal life, to people like me who are totally blind, to sighted parents who have a blind child, to blind parents who have sighted children, blind parents with blind children, and people of all ages, interests, and physical abilities. On today's program, the history of incubators and why many of us are alive and blind, how to avoid being bitten by ticks, and what to do if you are, and a better way to stand up. When I was a little kid, I went to the emergency room at Ellis Hospital, amounted to a freak show at the Coney Island Amusement Park in New York City, even though they were first invented at the end of the 1800s.
Incubators, or the idea of incubators, originally started in France, and it was really because of the war in France and the famine, and there was a push to increase the population. There was a physician there, Dr. Tarnier, who wanted to, thought that if we saved more babies, then we could increase the population. I mean, it wasn't wrong, stands to reason, but that included premature babies after they saw how many the premature baby lost.
Little in Schenectady, New York, where I was born. When I gave the nurse my name, she said, "You're pretty famous around here. You were the second most premature baby to live when you were born. We were all rooting for you." I was 90 days premature and weighed 2 pounds, 11 and 3 quarter ounces when I was born in June of 1942. I lived because Ellis Hospital had an incubator, which I stayed in for 10 weeks. It was one of the very first in a hospital in the United States. My mother told me the doctor told her to give me a name so you can bury him. Now that I lived, I hope I didn't piss him off. Up to that time, the only incubators in the United States were in
what they had. So he developed these, and they were pretty successful. And one of the people who an acquaintance of his was Martin Cooney, who actually, they call him Dr. Cooney, but there's no record at all that he had a medical degree or had any medical training whatsoever. But he wanted to bring that isolate or incubator technology sort of on the road, if you will. So he presented it at a fair in Berlin, and he would ask parents to just bring their premature babies and put them in these incubators and see how they did. And it turns out they did well, or better than dying. Cooney finally settled at Coney Island in New York, and where during the non-winter months, he would do the same thing. He would offer people to come bring their premature babies to him and put them in these incubators.
That's Dr. Robert Kiley.
I am a neonatologist physician that specializes in newborn intensive care at Children's Hospital Colorado in Colorado Springs.
What they found was, it wasn't just the incubators that were saving lives. It was the medical staff working with them.
What Martin Cooney did for the field of neonatology, more than just incubators, although that's what he's famous for, but sort of the subtext here is he actually paid trained nurses that he brought over from France, for the most part, to take care of these babies, which really underlies the fact that it's people caring for these kids that was one of the big reasons these kids actually did did much better than anybody had thought they would do, because he had nurses taking care of them also. And it wasn't just the technology that he brought over from France. It was the people that were caring for the babies. This bore out with, obviously, there were copycats and imitators saw what Cooney was doing at Coney Island and tried to take that same idea to other places in other parts of the country, only to have those babies have horrible outcomes. And the only difference was that they didn't have trained people taking care of these babies. So the technology was great, but in a vacuum, it's not. Even how we practice current day, it's not just the technology, it's the people behind the technology and the people caring for babies in our NICU back in Coney Island, no different.
It took more than 43 years between the time incubators were first invented and a small number of hospitals in the United States started using them.
When these things were first a sideshow kind of thing, like Coney Island, for example, was the most famous one. A person who ran that quote sideshow was actually tried to give that technology to hospitals, and they basically told them they were useless and when we don't need those, and those babies are quote weaklings is what they used to call them, won't survive anyway. It was a slow adopter, the hospitals were. Well, I think there was hesitancy to use the technology because they didn't think that it would really matter in the long run for these babies. Martin Cooney had to really gather all this data over 3 decades. This guy had, you know, in the turn of the century when he kind of brought it to Coney Island, and it wasn't until the early 40s until it was more readily adopted. So over 3 decades of saving 6,500 to 7,100 babies that he saved the lives of that otherwise would have just died.
Now that premature babies are being saved, a new problem has developed. Many of us were blind, bewildering doctors for about 11 years. Since premature babies have undeveloped lungs, the doctors were adding oxygen to the incubators or directly to the baby's lungs. What they didn't know was that extra oxygen damaged premature babies' eyes, causing what was called retrolentrofibroplasia, or if you're cool, RLF. It's now called retinopathy of prematurity.
It's truly the oxygen radicals that have caused scar tissue in the back of the eye. And then when the signal to those retinal blood vessels, those retinal arteries, the signal is, okay, now this baby's healthier, they're a little bit older, it's time for you to grow. As they start to grow, they've lost their way in the forest, so to speak, and they start to grow haphazardly instead of uniformly out to their distribute where they're going to distribute blood, and they grow haphazardly because of the oxygen damage to the back of their eye. And as they grow haphazardly, they can twist on themselves, they can turn, they can join up with each other, and they can start to lift the retina off the back surface of the eye. And if it gets to that point, then you're looking at blindness. And hopefully we're intervening before those blood vessels start to get too wonky.
As medicine advances, doctors are able to save more and more babies who are extremely premature. Blindness has become an issue again.
A blessing and have saved many, many thousands and thousands of lives that otherwise wouldn't have been saved without the technology. But the other thing is, because that technology exists, we're able to save babies younger and younger, as I mentioned, and the smaller you are and the worse lung disease you have, the higher oxygen needs that you then have to keep you alive. And those higher oxygen needs are what, as you mentioned, lead to an increased risk of that retinopathy of prematurity that can lead to blindness. Unfortunately, in this country nowadays, it's less common that kids go blind from it, but we still have about 400 to 600 babies in this country every year that do become legally blind from their extreme prematurity and oxygen exposure. Well, a term baby is considered 37 to 42 weeks, so that's considered term. So anything less than 37 weeks is preterm, but the kids who are at highest risk for retinopathy or prematurity now in this country and the way we care for them are the kids less than about 31 weeks. And birth weight kind of matters. We will still screen babies less than about 1,500 grams, which is a little under 4 pounds. It really matters more what your gestational age is. So we can have a baby who's, say, 33 weeks, but is very small, like has a lot of growth restriction in utero. And those babies probably aren't at the higher risk of retinopathy or prematurity. But once you start getting in the further below 31 weeks that you get, the higher the risk of the retinopathy or prematurity. So certainly in our babies who are 22 to that 25-week range or so, the risk of having retinopathy of prematurity is close to 100%. Fortunately, though, most of those cases, more than 90% of those, are going to be mild and resolve on their own. Yeah, you are a 23-ish weeker.
Dr. Likely says that babies given oxygen when being transported in helicopters is not an issue.
Those babies do have to have more, generally speaking, as they go up in altitude, they might have to take the percentage of oxygen that they're giving those babies up a little bit, or sometimes a more stable airway so that they are actually on a ventilator when they do that. But it does not increase the risk of retinopathy of prematurity. For retinopathy of prematurity, this is a long-term chronic exposure to high concentrations of oxygen, or a long-term, and we're talking long-term, we're talking over the first 4 to 5 weeks of life of the for the baby's life, not just a quick trip or even a more lengthy trip of a couple hours in a fixed wing plane, for example. That's not going to increase your risk of ROP, at least what we know of it.
Before I was born, the doctors gave my mother some shots that delayed my birth by 72 hours. The doctors are still doing that today, but now those shots are more sophisticated.
That's the conundrum right now throughout the world, is how to prevent prematurity. I'd love people to figure it out and put me out of business. That would be awesome. There are medications you can give mothers to kind of try and delay that process. Back when you were born, we weren't giving moms steroids. That's the other major advancement. So incubators, steroids, and surfactant are the three major advancements in the field. So when your mom went in complaining of contractions or in labor, they would now give her a shot of steroids and then 24 hours later give her another shot, hopefully give her medications to keep her pregnant for 72 hours. That would be the ideal, well, longer is ideal, but, and then after the second shot of steroids, 24 hours after that.
In my case, the oxygen destroyed my right eye right away, and I had to have it removed when I was a freshman in college. My left eye was also messed up by the oxygen, but I could still drive until about 12 years ago and had to have it removed 7 years ago. Emily Spinner and Blake Rosnowski helped with this story. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. Spring is here in North America. And along with blooming flowers and longer days are ticks, something you don't want to share your vacation with, or even just a walk down a bike trail.
Depends where you are, but spring is usually when they start coming out. They're found worldwide, I believe, except Antarctica. I don't believe that they have had any endemic ticks yet, mainly because they generally prefer warmth and humidity.
That's Dr. Patchula, an expert on ticks.
I am chief of neuroinfectious diseases and global neurology at the University of Colorado and Colorado School of Public Health.
Dr. Patchula says even tick experts can get too close to them.
In 2018, I had the fortunate ability to reach my 50th state in late May. And my 50th state that I've been to was Maine. So wanted to get a picture of coming, like, welcome to Maine sign. And jumped out of the car in May and got the quick picture. I maybe was out for what, maybe 3 minutes or so, trying to get pictures in front of the Maine sign so I can, you know, on social media be like, hey, I made my 50th state. And when I got back in the car, I found close to a dozen ticks on my jeans and socks. And it's because they were all questing in the vegetation right next to the sign. And certainly, like, I'm a tick-borne disease expert, and I'm not exempt either. So I immediately tried to knock as many off at the side of the road as I could. Then I carefully looked at the clothes further, kind of carefully looked at my legs, made sure I didn't have any on me. And then just for good measure, once we got to the hotel, took the clothes and put them in the dryer. And as far as I know, didn't get bit, didn't have any ticks attached to me. But that just shows how quickly they can get on you.
Ticks have been around a lot longer than we have.
Ticks are an external or ectoparasite that have evolved to feed on the blood of mammals, birds, reptiles, or amphibians. And they originated during the Cretaceous period about 150 to 50 million years ago. So they are much, much older than many mammals and certainly much older than humans.
Ticks are part of the ecosystem. They're a source of protein for some small animals and birds. Dr. Patchla says the best way to avoid ticks is to understand how they attach themselves to people, birds, and animals.
Most ticks, so the hard ticks that we're talking about, they can't fly and they can't jump, despite what people say. But what they do is they do this thing called questing. And questing is they climb on the top of vegetation, like a bush or some really high grass, and they hook their back legs behind and then stick their front legs out, and they'll just hold that position for hours until something walks by that it can then grab onto.
Dr. Patchla says tick bites can be fatal.
That's where ticks become particularly dangerous. It's not just the ticks biting an animal and sucking blood, but they also, through that action, then deliver these pathogens that live in ticks. And those pathogens could be cause severe disease or even potential death in the right circumstance. So ticks are bad news. So it's really important to try to avoid them as much as possible.
Ticks are difficult for sighted people to notice and impossible for us because ticks don't tick.
Ticks don't really make sounds at all. So I think here in this case, this is particularly challenging because ticks have evolved to kind of quietly and silently feed off of animals' blood. The point is you want to avoid that brushy high grass area or woody vegetation that ticks may be cresting on. So when hiking, it's really important as much as possible to stay on like cleared trails as much as possible. So if you're with someone or hiking with someone, just making sure that they help you stay on clear trails, or if you're able to just stay on well demarcated clear trails as much as possible and avoiding kind of going off the trail into brushier wood. And again, if you could have a companion, a hiking companion help you do that, or if you can pick a trail that you'd be able to navigate yourself, that's the first recommendation.
If you're walking or hiking in an area known for ticks, Dr. Patchla suggests when you get home, it's a good idea to do a tick check.
After being outdoors in tick environments, a couple things that people can do immediately. So what we recommend is if you're in a ticker environment is to remove your clothes and to shower after being outdoors. That does a couple things. So first off, ticks don't immediately, once they get on you, they don't immediately start biting and attaching. They like to like find an area where they're not going to be disturbed. So like armpits, scalp area, behind the ears, belly button, groin area around the waist. They like to go where they're not going to be disturbed. So it takes them time because they're not particularly like, they can't run. So it takes them time to kind of crawl and find an area. So while that tick is unattached, it's actually very easy to get them off. For instance, if you have some unattached ticks on you that are kind of crawling and trying to find a place, if you take a shower, it'll knock them off. Or if you take your clothes off, it'll knock any off that are your clothes. And then we recommend taking your clothes and then tumble drying them in the dryer with some heat, because that'll kill any ticks, because ticks don't really like heat. So that'll kill the ticks on your clothes, and then the shower will knock off any ticks that may have that are unattached. The tricky thing are looking for attached ticks and getting rid of them. This is where you probably need some help, in that these ticks can hide. It's sometimes hard to get off. Typically, if you find an attached tick, we recommend you grab the tick, or someone else can grab the tick with tweezers, and you pull straight out. There are some old school remedies that say like you should burn off a tick or put Vaseline or nail polish. No, don't do that. All you need to do is you grab a tick, grab it as close to the skin as possible, and you get tweezers and you just pull it straight out and then wash it with soap and water. Then the other thing is if you have pets, make sure the pets are checked for ticks as well, because pets can bring ticks that then come into the house. So it's important to have someone also check the dog for any ticks. It's possible that some of them can be very small, and sometimes you might not be able to feel them. If they're in kind of in gorge, it's possible you may be able to feel them. But I think it's important to be sure. So you might need to get your companion or family member or someone else to kind of, or friend to kind of help check your dog as well.
He also suggests that you use insect repellent that includes tick repellent for dogs and guide dogs approved by your vet. He also suggests not walking too close to the edge of roads and trails and wearing long pants tucked into your socks. And finally, Dr. Patchler says, avoid areas with high grass and lots of brush. Julia Milsner helped with this story. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low-vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. One of the things about being blind is that we don't see how other people do things. One of those things is how other people stand up. But if we could, we would see that most people stand up in a way that creates a lot of unnecessary stress on their bodies.
I think one of the things that we see clinically when we're working or when I'm working with a patient is a lot of times patients sit all the way back in their chair. And then when they're ready to rise out of the chair, their feet are lined up maybe shoulder width apart, and they go through all this effort to really kind of project their body weight over their feet as they're standing out of a chair. And so in some individuals, it puts excessive force on their knees. It can put excessive force on their low back because maybe they're not really efficiently using their hip musculature, which is one of the things that we want to see when someone does a proper, we call it like a chair ride. So when someone's getting out of a chair.
That's University of Colorado Medical School Professor Dr. Amy McDivitt.
I'm an associate professor in the physical therapy program at the Anschutz Medical Campus. I have a doctorate in physical therapy and then also a PhD in physiotherapy.
An easier way to stand up, move to the front of your chair, then bend over forward until you feel your weight over your knees, then stand up straight. After you've done it a couple of times, you'll just move to the front of your chair and lean forward, and you'll be standing up with a lot less stress on your back and knees. Do not try this if you're driving.
When someone does that, they're really putting their body mass in a little bit more of an efficient position, but they're also able to access some of the gluteal muscles, which we want to be driving that motion. So when an individual is sitting, their hip is in what's called flexion, so it's bent. And as we rise out of a chair into standing, the hip is then moving into what we call extension. And the main driver of that movement is really the gluteus maximus. And so by just scooting to the edge of the chair, putting weight equally through both heels, as your trunk leans forward and you push through your heels, really just provides for a more efficient way to accomplish that sit to stand activity with a little less stress in some circumstances on people's knees or on their lumbar spine.
Dr. McDivitt says it's even more important to stand up correctly when you're holding a baby.
If your arms are full, if you're holding a baby, if you're holding on to any type of load, you're transferring that load much more efficiently when you're able to really put weight through your heels.
Megan Strahan and Julia Meltzer helped with this story. You're listening to The Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. I'm Nick Eisenberg. Why, it's my talking scale, reminding us that we'd like you to weigh in on how we're doing. Please let us know by sending an email to thetactiletraveler@gmail.com. We spell Traveler the American way with one L. We'd also like to hear your story ideas from all over the world. Send us an email with story ideas in the subject line at thetactiletraveler@gmail.com. Transcripts of this program are also available for our deaf listeners by searching The Tactile Traveler in any search engine. This program is also being broadcast on AfterSight, formerly the Audio Information Network of Colorado, and on additional audio information networks. It's also available by typing the Tactile Traveler into any search engine and available wherever you get podcasts, and by asking your smart speaker to play the podcast, The Tactile Traveler. We'd like to thank the following people who helped make today's program possible. Be My Eyes Microsoft Accessibility Tech Support, Apple Accessibility Tech Support, Leslie Steffens, Pat Conroe, Lorraine Hutchinson, Debbie O'Leary, Sarah Williams, Sophia Williams, Cody Lee,
Hope Apps, Amu,
Kaylee Romero, and Raleigh Burley. This has been the Tactile Traveler, empowering blind and low vision people to explore the world and helping our sighted friends see the world in a new way. This is a production of KDNK Community Access Radio, Carbondale, Colorado.